Monster Man, special episode, Monsters of the Volsungs.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity of my Patreon backers, and in particular, of Patreon backer Ozzy. Ozzy has asked me to talk about Monsters of the Nibelungenlied, and this is kind of a follow-up to Ozzy's last special episode, which was all about the Lindworm. In a minute, we're going to see why Monsters of the Nibelungenlied is a challenging topic, and we're going to expand our remit to other medieval stories of the Volsungs. But before we do that, I just want to say that if you'd like to be like Ozzy and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll also get the rewards for lower levels, including periodic bonus content, which I've got some coming out pretty soon, since it's the end of the month. By the time you're hearing this, it's the beginning of the next month, really. My other podcast, Patron Deities, which is all about the Deities and Demigods book and is currently, as well as my other podcast, Patron Deities, which is all about the Deities and Demigods book and about using religion and mythology in role-playing games, and which is currently going through a series on Japanese mythology. So Ozzy, thank you very much, and I hope that you enjoy this episode. I don't want to put Ozzy in the soup. Ozzy said the Nibelungenlied or something like that. You know, Ozzy was, I think, thinking of kind of medieval heroic literature. And I took that literally and went at the Nibelungenlied only to be reminded that we had already done this episode about Fafnir, who's really one of only a couple of monsters in the whole Nibelungenlied. So before we take a look at some other monsters, I want to talk a little bit about the literary background that we're discussing here. The Nibelungenlied is a very early 13th century, probably, so probably from around 1200, German epic, written probably somewhere around Passau in Bavaria, and it's an interesting text because what it is one expression of what seems to have been a relatively large body of stories about a certain group of characters, about Siegfried and Brunhild and their various rivals and allies. And if those names sound familiar to you, it's probably because they're well known from Wagner's Ring Cycle. But although it contains the name, the Ring of the Nibelungen, the Ring Cycle is not really based on the Nibelungenlied, but on other stories about Siegfried and Brunhild, although it takes those stories, which are mostly from Scandinavia, and gives the characters their German names. So in the Volsungasaga, which is what the Ring is mainly based on, the lead is called Sigurd. But there are lots of other poems and prose works and works of art that deal with these tales, and indeed some that suggest other different versions of the story. So for example, Beowulf refers to Sigmund and his nephew, he's called something else in Beowulf, he's called Fitela, I think, and anyway, we're going to encounter him in the Volsungasaga as Sinfjotli. I'm probably mispronouncing that. And there's some suggestion that, you know, they may have been protagonists of an independent tale that kind of got added to the story of Sigurd, or that they may have been originally protagonists who then had Sigurd's story grafted onto theirs. I don't know. But Sigurd is not mentioned in Beowulf, although Sigmund is. I think it's best to think of these texts as a body of lore that produces a number of different literary works. Initially, I sort of assumed that the Nibelungenlied was a later medievalization, a kind of chivalric romancification of the Scandinavian stories, but actually, the Nibelungenlied is earlier than the Volsungasaga. I mean, a little bit earlier. They're both from the 1200s. The Volsungasaga is based on older poetry, but it doesn't make any effort to kind of bring those up to date in a medieval style. So it's a mistake, I think, to assume what I may have unconsciously been assuming, that particular artistic elements mean that the story is older or more authentic. That's grim thinking, and you don't want to do that. So I think it's best to think of them as among the many expressions of a tradition as it makes its way through European literature. Now, when we take a look at the Nibelungenlied itself, it is much more focused on courtly intrigue and romance, and it limits its supernatural elements. There are really mainly two supernatural elements in the Nibelungenlied. Well, there are two monsters. There are mainly two monsters in the Nibelungenlied. One is the story of Siegfried slaying a dragon, and as I mentioned last time we talked about the Nibelungenlied in the Lindworm episode, this is confined to a flashback. It is a story told by another character about Siegfried, not something that actually happens in the action of the story itself. It's used as evidence to demonstrate how great Siegfried is, but it's not really given the focus that it is in other stories about this character. The other story is a very common, I think, romance motif, which is toward the climax of the piece. A lot of the characters are on their way to the land of the Huns, and they have to cross a river that is in flood. And Hagen, the Is He a Baddie character, goes off to look for the ferryman, and instead what he finds are some, my translation that I have, that's the Dover Thrift Edition translation, calls them wise women, but they're clearly some kind of water spirits, and he sees them bathing. And if you are a character in a folktale, and you see some nymphs bathing, obviously what you do is steal their clothes. And in order to get them to give the clothes back, they offer to tell his future, and the first nymph says, you know, oh, or perhaps we could call them, you know, Nixies or whatever. The first one says, everything's going to be great for you. You know, you have a bright future ahead of you, Hagen. And then the next one comes along and says, don't listen to my sister. She just told you that to get back at you for stealing her clothes. In fact, you're going to die. And not only are you going to die, but everyone who's traveling with you is going to die except for this one priest. So Hagen, who is something of an awkward character, doesn't necessarily believe this. He finally goes, he finds the ferryman, he gets everybody on the boat, they're rowing across the river, and he grabs the priest and throws him overboard because he wants to prove that the prophecy isn't going to come true. You know, the prophecy said that the priest would not die, so Hagen's going to try and kill him. Now, in fact, God intervenes and the priest safely makes it to the shore. But that kind of thing, Hagen's response to this supernatural creature, is used to illustrate sort of the futility of fighting against your fate. This is a theme that's going to run through multiple adaptations of the story of, you know, Sigurd the Dragon Slayer and or the Ring of the Nibelungen. There are going to be many cases where people are told that they're fated to die, and their response is very different. So in Hagen's case, he disbelieves the prophecy and tries to prove it wrong, whereas in the Volsunga saga, in keeping with kind of the literary conventions of Old Norse heroic literature, we're going to see people expressing unconcern about this fact. Fafnir tells Sigurd that the treasure is going to cause his death, and Sigurd says, can it cause me to die more than once? No? Well, then that's fine. I was going to die anyway. But brave men desire to become rich while they're alive. I'm paraphrasing, but that's the gist of it. Or in another case, one of the characters, I think Volsung, is told that if he does something, he's going to die. And he says, I would rather die than have it be thought that I was afraid to die. So the Nibelungenlied is a story about human, if exceptional, characters. And the inclusion of monsters is there to kind of emphasize unusual parts of those characters' background or to mark important turning points in the story. But the monsters are far from the focus of the tale. This is a story about human characters and the relationships between those characters. The central drama is driven by the romantic plot, which is less true in the Volsunga saga. When you don't start with Siegfried or Sigurd, and you start with kind of all the people ahead of him, then the romantic plot kind of becomes one of the many adventures of these characters. So the Volsunga saga is a prose version of the story of the Volsungs based on Eddic poetry. And we have most of the poems that the saga is based on, but there actually are some that are now missing, where we have to reconstruct the story from the prose adaptation of poems that no longer exist. So the Volsunga saga was composed after the Nibelungenlied, but is based on material that was probably earlier. The Volsunga saga is much more supernatural and mythological than the Nibelungenlied. I've been reading the translation by Jesse Byock, and in that translation, Odin appears in line one. There are magical babies, there are giant maidens who turn into crows, they deliver magic apples, people build their halls around giant trees, Odin sticks a magic sword into the giant tree, etc., etc. This made me think that this is the kind of magical atmosphere that I'd really like to see in some games, and it may be why I like Glorantha so much, because it seems to me that only Glorantha really achieves it. High magic systems, such as Dungeons & Dragons 5th edition, should be able to do it, but most often I feel like they don't achieve it. And instead they reach a different kind of magic-saturated world where there's a sense of magical mundanity. What I mean is that there is a ton of magic and a lot of supernatural events kicking around the world of the Volsunga Saga. These are clearly characters who live in an ambiguous position between the world of mortals and the world of the divine or the supernatural. And these characters all experience magic and monsters, and they treat them seriously and they treat them with respect, but they're not surprised by them. They don't not believe that magic exists, and they're willing to accept that magical stuff is happening to them. So that's what I mean by Glorantha, which is a world where magic is commonplace, everyone does magic, but it has retained its central importance as a focus of community life and a connection to spirituality. Whereas, I think in most D&D 5th edition games, magic is very commonplace, and as a result, it sort of loses its sense of wonder. Well, maybe not wonder, but it loses its sense of importance. Magic turns into a kind of substitute for technology, and is used in the same way that people, I mean, including me, use technology, which is to say, without really thinking about it. And that makes sense because in a fully magical world, there are certain ways in which you just can't think about magic in order for it to make sense. It's tough. You can't apply science fictional thinking to a mythical game, but in general, that's what we try to do. So if you want monsters, the Volsunga Saga is full of them. We've got giants who can change their shape. We've got wolves who may be humans who shape-changed into wolves. We've got sorceresses who can change their shape. We've got cursed werewolves. These are the sons of princes who have been given cursed wolf skins that turn them into wolves every some particular number of nights. 10 nights, I think. So they're shape-changers. We've got Norns, and this is a little weird. They don't change their shape. That's odd. We've got a mysterious otherworldly boatman who seems at first like he's just a guy in a boat, but don't worry, it's Odin who has changed his shape. We've got the aforementioned Lindworm or Serpent who was originally a human or maybe a god who shape-changed into the serpent. We've got a were-otter who is the dragon's brother, so he's another shapeshifter. We've got a dwarf who's able to change his shape into a fish. We've got some Valkyries. They don't change their shapes a lot, which is a bit weird. And we've got lots of encounters with Odin, sometimes in the flimsiest of disguises, and sometimes changing his shape. You may be able to detect a theme emerging here. I like Odin in this story because he's not making a lot of effort. Odin appears in the form of like an old man with a long beard and sometimes one eye or a big hat or a hood who makes cryptic declarations or offers people bits of advice or just does something weird like stick a sword into a tree. And then later on people go, oh, that was Odin. Like, yeah, no kidding, it was Odin. Who'd you think it was, your uncle? Odin is literally some of these characters' uncle, but you know what I mean. Yeah, the Nibelungen lead treats magic and monsters as real, though comparatively rare, and uses them to emphasize key themes about fate and what happens to those who defy it. You even get the sense that the author was maybe not wild about the dragon episode, but couldn't leave it out because that's a story that everybody knows about Siegfried. With the Volsunga Saga, these monsters represent a world of magic and monsters. We know that we are in an age of heroes with superhuman abilities, characters who blur the line between mortals and gods, and the fact that there are monsters just lying around the landscape everywhere serves to emphasize that fact. I do think that the specific treatment of magic and monsters in the Volsunga Saga is interesting. Most of the monsters are human or humanized in some way. So, you know, Fafnir has some tragic wisdom to impart as he dies, and there are definitely monstrous protagonists too. You could maybe say that about Brunhild. You know, there is something inhuman about her. She was, you know, she's a giant's foster daughter. She's a Valkyrie. She is human, and we meet, like, other human members of her family, but there is something otherworldly about her, as there should be. The same is true of a lesser character, Sinfjotli, who, though his parentage is a bit awkward, but also he goes through this period where he's living in the wilds as an outlaw with his father, who is also living in the wilds as an outlaw. And his Volsung heritage is revealed by his ruthlessness, his willingness to kill, and he becomes, he takes one of these wolf skins and he becomes, you know, a shape changer, changes into a wolf, and this sort of serves to illustrate his rashness when he tries to take on 11 men by himself, and he's badly wounded, and his father has to call on Odin to heal him. But there's something monstrous about Sinfjotli afterwards. He kind of violates the rules of society, and he gets into an insult contest with a rival who says, I'm surprised to see you here in the company of good men, you who have sucked the blood out of cold corpses. You've lived the life of a wolf. And of course, this is playing on the idea that both the outlaw and the wolf are creatures who live beyond the boundaries of civilization, who live in the wood, who live in human lives. And Sigmund, after he returns from the wood, doesn't seem to have any trouble returning to the life of a human. And I think there's always something a little bit weird about Sinfjotli. But that's an extreme case of that thing of characters being, you know, a little bit human and a little bit divine or a little bit monstrous. And that is represented, I think, in particular by the presence of shape changing as a monster motif in this. Nearly every supernatural creature reveals itself by being able to appear in more than one form. I mean, genuinely, almost all of them, including creatures that we don't normally think of as being able to change their shape, like Andvari the dwarf, who is able to turn into a fish. The ability to not always appear in the same form seems to kind of be the type ability for superhuman power in Old Norse literature. A bit like if you try to think about superhuman power in modern culture, modern popular culture, I would say that probably the type of power is flying. Whether that's Superman, whether it's Harry Potter flying around on his broomstick or witches on broomsticks, you know, I think that if you need to convey the idea of a super powerful character, the easiest way to do that is to show them in flight. You know, if you show them lifting something heavy, that might just be like cartoonish exaggeration. We might be dealing with a sort of Gaston type character, like he's not super powerful, he's just buff. And I think in Old Norse literature, it's shape changing. Characters who can appear in other forms, that's the distinctive quality of being supernatural. But I don't know, just something that occurred to me while I was reading this. But it's just such a repeated motif throughout the entire saga that it seems like you can't ignore that it's there. You know, people talk about how old school D&D is closer to the sources, and I think that that very much depends on how you view the sources. If you look at the sources and you see, like, Fofford and the Grey Mouser, okay, but in terms of the legendary or mythological material, then I think that, you know, 5th ed D&D is more like the Volsunga Saga than any old school version of D&D. A lot of medieval heroic literature deals with people who are exceptionally powerful. Now, having said that, you know, maybe that's not true because 5th ed D&D kind of draws more on that sort of like wuxia anime idea of like the martial arts narrative of heroes who exist in a world of characters who have extraordinary abilities, which is a bit more like your kind of superhero universe narrative. Sigurd is always running into people who are powerful, although not as powerful as him. Brunhild and Gudrun have this argument about who is the most exceptional prince. And of course, the answer is Sigurd, which is annoying if your brothers are also princes. So maybe if you assume that the setting is just full of kind of mundane magic, then they're not that similar. But still, I think the idea of very powerful protagonists with a suite of different abilities is consistent here, right? Like Sigurd has, in addition to his great combat ability and his, you know, great wisdom, he learns a bunch of rune lore from Brunhild. He can speak the language of birds because he took a little bit of the dragon's blood into his mouth. It's not like he even has just one power or one thematic set of powers. He just has a whole bunch of powers. He's like Superman discovering that he has super telepathy or the ability to shoot a bunch of tiny Superman out of his fingers. He's just got whatever powers the story requires him to have, to be honest. As do all story heroes. But so the monsters in this version of the telling are the lines between them and the protagonists of the story are blurred. And I think that that is quite interesting. You know, I don't think, other than maybe the wolf that eats a bunch of captives, there aren't too many monsters in the Volsung Saga that I would say are clearly bad guys. Even Fafnir, who is presented as a dangerous challenge for Sigurd to overcome, is presented sympathetically in the moment of his death. Other than that, you know, the sorceress, the shape-shifting sorceress, is a plot contrivance that allows something to happen, you know, that allows someone not to know who Signy is at one point. You know, the werewolf story is there to illustrate an aspect of Sinfjotli's character, and Sinfjotli is marked by that story in a way that, like, a lot of the story seems to be concerned with the necessity for violence, but also the poisonous effects of violence and of revenge. You know, Signy devotes her whole life to avenging her family. And as a result, she describes herself as by no means fit to live. You know, by doing so, she has put herself outside the bounds of human society. Kind of a recurring theme here. So maybe to go way back to a couple of seasons ago and talk about the idea of monstrous player characters, one of the recurring themes of the Volsunga saga is the idea that heroism is itself sort of monstrous, or at least it can be. Sigurd is a great guy, but his antecedents include a lot of people who border on the awful. They have a great deal of power, but maybe they're not as civilized or humane as they could be, and even Sigurd himself, although he has great power, does not always use it wisely, because frankly, he's not that bright. Also, the story's a little confused. Anyway, I do think that comparing these two stories is fascinating. I mean, if you look at the Nibelungen Lied, it's not that it doesn't have supernatural elements, because it absolutely does, and it still plays with the same kind of ideas of fate and destiny, and, you know, how to deal with knowing your future that we get in the Volsunga saga, but it is much more concerned with the romantic and courtly, and I guess political, elements of its plot. It is not, if I had to pick a word to describe the Volsunga saga, the Nibelungen Lieds, not weird. And I think that's maybe the crucial difference. So it's very interesting to see how the same story, and indeed one of the same monsters, can be taken, but presented in two quite different ways. So yeah, that didn't wind up talking in detail about any specific monster, but I think it's a good example of how to use a particular set of monsters with kind of a shared theme to build some thematic content into a campaign and reinforce one of the main questions that the Volsunga saga is trying to ask about the nature and costs of a code of heroism. All right, that's about all the medieval literature that we've got time for today. Ozzy, I hope that you enjoyed your episode. If you'd like to be like Ozzy and get your own special episode, remember that all you have to do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do so, you'll get access to patron deities as well. We've got an episode of Patron Deities coming out this week. Our next episode is going to be a My Favorite Monster special. I sat down with game creator Ruth Tillman to talk about the Creeping Kudzu, a monster that she created for a zine that she published last year. So tune in on Friday for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.